good. All right, Steve Weeks here, the Ultimate Podcast. We're back on the air after being on vacation. This is season 3. Yes, season 3 of the show. I know you may be a little confused. I didn't really have a season finale for season 2. During the summer, I'm really busy, and it just came up on me so quick. I didn't have a show ready, so I'm apologize about that. We're just going to go right into season 3. We got a good show for you tonight. I think we do. I'm going to start out doing something I've never done before. You know, a lot of times, if you had followed the show, you know, I can't post now on Board Game Geek from being banned, but you don't really get a sense of how these shows are coming across, you know, how many people they're reaching, and I just thought I would read through you. I'm going to be going through this emails that I get. On my website, there's really no place for comments, for people to comment, so they send me email, and I thought you guys might like to take a behind-the-scenes look here at the Ultimate Podcast, seeing what kind of feedback we're getting on the show, because the feedback you got over when I could post over on Board Game Geek and when some other people post announcing the show, it's, you know, it's just from the hive, over the hive mentality, the collective over there. And it's not really indicative of really, you know, it gets into basically a pissing contest over there of who can insult the show the most. But good and bad here. I'm going to read good and bad for you, but it's really not a lot of really heavy hate mail here that I get by email. Not what you would think after reading some of the posts on the Geek. But I want to just start out here going through it. I apologize to the people that send me email that I don't respond to. I just get a lot of it. And hopefully you'll hear your email here tonight. If I didn't respond, just consider this a response, an audio response to it. I do respond to some when I get a chance. But I just, like I said, especially during the summer, I'm really busy here. And it doesn't... I really don't get a chance to do it. So let me start here. This one's from Kyle. I'll just say his name's Kyle. He says, Steve, I live in an area full of Euro snoots. I can confirm that they travel in packs. I've developed a handy survival guide that has saved my life on more than one occasion. I guess he's doing comedy here for me. Okay. Hopefully you can pass along to save the lives of other Ameritrash fans. Number one, avoid places where Euro snoots congregate. Any academic institution should be treated with caution. Philosophy departments are especially dangerous. Okay. Number two, when in doubt, look for places with children. Euro snoots spend very little time with their children. Gaming is much more important to them. Ooh. Better yet, find a place with women and children. Eurosnoots are known to be scared of both. Okay. Number three, if you purchase your coffee at the local mini mart, consider transferring it into a Starbucks mug. This will draw much less suspicion. Refer to your Egg McMuffin as an English egg pastry. Little changes such as this will let you blend in until you can get to safety. Number four, if you're pursued, be prepared. Always carry a bag of cubes. Drop them at the beginning of the chase. A Euro snoot can't resist stopping to look at cubes. Better yet, carry cubes of similar colors. They'll spend hours trying to figure out if a cube is purple or eggplant. Okay. All right. And we're going to go on down here. I thought one of these... He goes on with this, and I won't put you through all of this. Kyle, lead the comedy of me, okay? All right. But he goes, I especially like number 8 here where he goes, don't ever admit to paying for a game, especially one that you have reviewed. This is sure to out you. I hope this helps others as much as it's helped me. Thanks, Kyle. Thank you for that, Kyle. The next email comes from a guy called Lurking Meeple. He writes, despite what you might assume from my Euro-esque username, I, quote, loved the through the desert session report in your webcast. You know, I got a lot of email on that. You never know how some of this stuff goes over, and they really love that. If you didn't hear that on one of the shows I did, a session report with Through the Desert where I basically fell asleep. And one guy had wrote that he was laughing so hard that at work, he was listening to it at work, that the people thought he was crazy in his cubicle. But let me go on with this guy's email. He goes, I don't quite, quote, get the whole supposed AT versus Euro divide, but the trash talking is a hoot. He says, friendly suggestion, add a little more self-AT deprecating humor to win over more folks. And here's my take on mocking my roots and AT at the same time. And he gives a link to an article on the Board Game Geek. Regards, lurking meeple, semi-anonymous coward. Okay, thank you for that. This one's from Paul. Steve, sorry to send a message off the forum, but I didn't want to get a ruckus going. He says he's a mellow A-tier. Okay. He just noticed a couple of things about the Dice Tower this week. He said, first, it looks like I've touched a nerve. Vassal and company are addressing the, quote, free games for reviews issue. And he goes, man, you must be doing something right. Keep up the good work on the show, Paul. This has been a while back, but you may recall that on the Dice Tower. Stephen Glenn writes, he said he just got a chance to listen to the Michael Barnes interview. He goes, absolutely compelling on every level. And a seminal interview in modern gaming, but that's just my opinion. Keep up the good work. Your show is infuriating, inspirational, and hilarious. Steven Snoop Glenn, and he signs Euro Snob. Thank you, Steven. Let's go on. This one comes from, he calls himself the Last Alchemist. He goes, Steve, I'm sure you've been inundated with this already, but I thought it was interesting and just wanted to make sure it came to your attention. Haven't actually listened to the podcast yet. He says the Dice Tower, number 91, influential games, and number 90, Tide of Iron. And we have a discussion. He's quoting the description on the Dice Tower. We have a discussion about whether or not free review copies sway the opinion of the reviewer. With input from Moritz, Greg Schlosser, and Sam and myself, Tom Vassell. He goes, seems you're starting to bug them. Keep up the great show. I always look forward to Mondays now. The Last Alchemist. Yeah, you don't have to, for those of you don't have to bother listening to those Dice Tower episodes over there about the discussion of whether or not free review copies sway the opinion. I can sum it up in one word. Yes, they do sway the opinion. So, there you go. Let's move on. This comes from Dan Casey. Steve, first off, man, your podcast is awesome. Thank you, Dan. I've lost track of how many times I've spit water all over my monitor when listening to your show. He goes, the Right On Gospel segments in Aldi's interview were hysterical, and I totally cracked up at your Through the Desert session report in show number 4, and I actually like Through the Desert, he says. I appreciate the way you are talking about the larger gaming culture in general rather than diving into hyper detail on how games play. And, you know, for those of you that say, you know, my show needs to be talk more about games rather than the culture, you see what I get here. Some people like it, some don't. So, you know, you can't please everybody, and I've said that many times. You know, we're just going to do what we do here. His letter goes on, it's fantastic. It really is. You've got everything very well organized, and you're doing something unique and different and having fun with it. Yes, we are. He goes, I know you've heard this a million times, but your iTunes feed is whacked. Yes, I have heard that a million times. Anyway, keep up the good work. I think we got the iTunes problem licked, but believe me, I hear when it's not working. He goes, P.S., people say whatever everywhere. I've never been anywhere and not heard it. Then again, I've never been to Texas. He's referring to the episode, I guess, when I was making fun of Dirk, always saying whatever. But thank you, Dan, for those great comments, and I appreciate that. Let's go on to, this is from Mike. Apparently, this guy does a podcast himself. I've never heard it, but he wants to know, just out of interest, what recording software do I use? He says, your sound quality is so, with a lot of O's, much better than ours. Cheers, Mike. Thank you for that, Mike. Several people have asked me this. All of you asked me this, but I didn't include it on the interview on the podcast. We got to talking about technical stuff. I didn't know how many people were really interested in that. That's why I cut it out. But I do use a, it's very simple. I just use a speakerphone, and I use a Shure SM57 mic on the speakerphone, and then I have all the software that's rather expensive. I already had it for my music stuff that I do, so it would really be more, to do a podcast, it'd be ridiculous to buy all that just for that, but I already had it in place. So a lot of the, I use a lot of plugins and stuff, software, and my computer's really not that powerful. You really don't need a powerful computer to run, to get good quality audio, yeah, it's basically simple stuff. If you can, if you want to pay for the software, you can get the quality. And thanks for the email, Mike. I do get a lot of email from Barnes and Company, and I'll read you this one. It's pretty funny. Talking about Rick Thorne, he calls him Rick Thornquits after Thornquits resigned from the Geek. His response, he writes, "Damn, Steve, I got to hand it to you. When we got this AT ball rolling, I never would have dreamed that its first casualty would be Rick Thornquits. I can imagine his cartoon avatar frowning over in the corner." Okay. Anyway, not to rhapsodize, that was a great podcast. Just want to let you know, I mean, there's really no one out there doing it like you are. I really appreciate your approach. You're like a Bill Hicks of Board Game Geek at this point. Thank you, Michael. Michael and I correspond quite a bit, and some of it definitely can't be read on the air or really anywhere in public. So, but I thought that was funny. I may have another one here. I read a little bit that from him that was funny too. But let me move on. Jim Brooks writes, "Steve, I love your podcast. I hope you have Barnes back on the show now that he is an outcast. Time to take the gloves off. I don't know if you're serious about Ameritrash Convention, but I'm all for the Houston location. I think the perfect name would be the Gathering of Enemies. Seems like the perfect FU to the Eurosnoots. Jim." Yeah, thank you, Jim, for your comments. We haven't really heard much on the convention. I think we were going to decide to have it in Atlanta, but I really turned all of that over to Barnes, and I'll let you know as soon as we hear something on that. It sounds like it's still in the planning stages, but I'll get back to you on that. Let me keep going. Scott Brooks. "Steve, first off, I'd like to say that I enjoy your podcast. I think they are funny, and you have a great slate of gaming personalities that I thought were entertaining and insightful. I agree that Ameritrash games have been looked down on in the past at the Geek, and I'm glad that this has been brought out for all to see and think about. I very much agreed with Dirk's comments about Euros. I was in a gaming group that mostly played the newest and latest Essen releases, and finally had to admit that I was bored to tears with influence, prestige points, and all the other boring stuff that seems to get rehashed over and over." He says he did a geek list several months before the Ameritrash versus Euro debate flamed up, wondering why I didn't like most of the top 10 games on Board Game Geek. It's called, quote, "tipping sacred cows" for what it's worth. And then he goes on to give me a little constructive criticism. He didn't like some of my comments about Tom Vessel. He felt like it was legitimate to question whether or not he was getting free games and they could buy us a review. But he says, "I thought you crossed the line when you said that Tom was just doing the reviews to get free games." He is. And that he was trying to set him up as the next Greg Schlosser. Actually, I didn't say that. Dirk did. He goes on to say he doesn't know that I don't know Tom personally, and how do I know his motives, and so forth and so on. This next one comes from Lyman, a guy named Lyman. He goes, "Any chance you could list on my website," he's talking about the League Radio website, "some links to game sites where the admins do not arbitrarily and unfairly ban users based on an honest difference of opinion? A number of us are looking for greener pastures. Thanks, Lyman." Yeah, I wish I could. It seems like Board Game Geek is the dominant board gaming site. Although, we do have one, Gleemax, is in, and we next week we're going to talk to Dirk about Gleamax, and looks like it's shaping up to be a competitor of Board Game Geek, and I think that's great. It gives us gamers more options out there, and it's going to be interesting to see Gleamax on the scene. Let's move along. This one comes from Donald. He goes, when you're not using language that's couched in a way to be insulting, you have a hell of a podcast. What do I like about it? I really like the in-person examples of play. I like your enthusiasm and your energy. I like your creativity. I hope you keep them coming after your break. Bias is not a bad thing, but I agree with what Dirk said about how to ask questions in a way that won't have people writing off your opinion before you get around to making a point. And he goes, now that the back slapping's over, he's got a lot of criticism here. He doesn't like the derogatory terms I use, like Eurosnoot or Ameritrash. He goes, Eurosnoot is insulting, divisive, and derogatory. You use the term like a personal attack, and anyone feeling that it is well within reason. To claim Eurosnoot is not at least a bit divisive and insulting is disingenuous at best. Asserting that this is all in fun does not excuse crassness, nor after the fact that such behavior is worse and more overt than the people you are persecuting. I don't think I'm persecuting anybody, but he really sounds like a Eurosnoot, doesn't he? He goes on, Ameritrash originally meant crappy board games produced in the U.S. before the age of Avalon Hill. Why the heck would anyone willingly choose that title for some of the best games ever produced? I kind of agree with him here. I never really liked the Ameritrash term either, but unfortunately, for better or worse, it's stuck. And I think everybody knows what we're talking about when we say Ameritrash. He goes, why would you choose the title? Title a genre of game, something that you would discipline novice or younger players to engage in playing them. I didn't choose the title. It's just one that came up and stuck. He makes an interesting point here. He goes, the latest offerings of games like Tide of Iron, Battle Lore, and the reissue of Hannibal have occurred because the Euro games sustained a dwindling board game market against the assault of CCGs, role-playing games, computer games, etc. Not only did Euro show distributors that quality board games would still sell, but help revitalize interest in a sagging market, they also helped inspire people like Dirk and Ollie to offer an amazing service like Board Game Geek. Thank you for those comments. He goes on in quite a bit there. Let's go on. This one's from David H. As a Board Game Geek member now feeling the big chill and subsequent gag rules, I salute you. What you say and what you do, I'll be listening very closely to what comes next. I, for one, will not go quietly into the night on this issue. David H. Thank you, David. We agree with that. I responded to that. I go, thanks for listening, and he goes, trust me, I'm all ears. I feel so betrayed by Board Game Geek right now. I thought we had set ourselves higher standards, but the moralistic morons doing their functionality retarded two-step on our fine fellow fall fan makes me sick to my stomach. That's very well put, David. Thank you for the comments. Let's see. Moving right along here. This is from Timmy. Okay, this is the evil Timmy guy. He's had a lot of criticism on my podcast, but he's responding here to a thread that I wrote. I said there was going to be a seminar on writing game reviews that would be run by Michael Barnes at the Ameritrash convention, and of course the thread went totally out of whack. And here's his letter. Timmy writes, what? That thread started out relatively tongue-in-cheek, and the throngs came out to trash you instantly. Yes, they did. What gives? He goes, Christ, it's like the Dems taking over Congress or something. Since the banning of Barnes, suddenly everyone has a spine. Yes, I noticed that. He goes, there was absolutely zero that was offensive in the original post. Yeah, you were baiting a little, but I'm really not understanding the overreaction. What's up everyone's butt? Jeez. Respectfully, Tim. Thank you, Tim. I'm glad you noticed that. And thanks for the email. This one comes from Brady. He goes, "Hi, Steve. I saw you mention that an AT convention is in the works." He said, "It sounds like a great idea, and he'd love to attend." And he goes on to suggest that we have it in Austin. They have a convention there, the Millennium Con, in Austin, Texas. So some of you guys might want to check that out. It's a lot of miniatures there, but they do have board gaming and other games as well. This is from Kyle. "Steve, I see you've had an impact on the old guard. Greg Schlosser obviously felt pressure to review a game negatively, lest we believe that free copies influence their reviews. Of course, the best Schlosser could do for a negative review was Dilbert, as if he'd ever admit to enjoying that game." And he gives me the link to Schlosser's review on Board Game News of Dilbert the Board Game. He goes on to say, "I finally got around to listening to Tom's rant about free copies in episode 90 of the Dice Snoozer." I like that. He goes, "I like how everyone is now claiming that it's just so much, quote, work, as if they would do it if they didn't want to. He really treats his users like they are stupid. Keep up the great work, Kyle." Okay. Thank you, Kyle. All right. This next one is from Stephen in the UK. He goes, "Hey, Steve, keep up the good work on the show. Coming into board gaming recently, I naturally gobbled up a whole bunch of different podcasts, trying to get a feel for what's what. I listened to enough designer interviews, dry roasted session reports, and rules rundown reviews to last a lifetime." I like that, dry roasted session reports. He goes on to say, "I've served my time on other forums for different things, and I find the notion of controversy here hilarious. Most people here would faint from shock if they ever strayed from Board Game Geek. It's probably the most civil, large-scale community I've ever been a part of." Dirk and Aldi should like that comment. He goes on to say, "By the way, they didn't really ban you for 2 weeks." Yes, they did. Cheers, Stephen. Thank you for your comment, Stephen. This next one's from Steve B. He goes, "Let me start out saying that the second interview was even better than the first." He's talking about the second Barnes interview. "Entertaining, funny, informative, and chock full of great comments from both of you guys. Loved it. As well as the songs and monologue before the interview. Of particular interest to me was your mentioning my avatar on Board Game Geek, the drawing I did of Michael Barnes' avatar from where he was on Board Game Geek." This is the guy that has the avatar that kind of looks like a cartoon of Barnes. He says he gets a chuckle out of that. He goes, "Yes, I am aware that the gruesome guy is not a photo of Barnes himself, but so many people have come to think it is. I am sure most Eurogamers will love their Woody Wonders, prefer to think that Avatar really is a visage of Michael Barnes." He goes on to say, "By the way, one of these days you should really offer the entire podcast shows on CD or DVD. I would buy it just to listen to it in a few years. Keep up the good work, Steve B." Well, thank you for the comments, Steve. If there's enough interest, I will do that. A couple of people have mentioned that, and it might be something to think about. I'll keep it in mind. Gentleman in the Netherlands, Jur, I think Jur is his name. He says, "If you ever get to visit the Netherlands, feel free to contact me and have a beer and perhaps a game of Kalis." Maybe the beer, okay. "Good luck sitting out your suspension. I must say I didn't get the joke, but hadn't dealt with the cognitive dissonance yet." Whatever that means. I'm glad it was a joke after all. I think he's talking about the Aldi, when I said that Aldi was trying to get me banned from my website. He goes, "I can still understand Aldi getting pissed over that. I can see you not giving in, given the Barnes issue, but you are two grown men. You can sort that out yourselves. Have a good time, juror. Thank you, juror. This one's from James B. Steve, I don't know if you caught this latest gem, but I'll direct your attention to Exhibit A in the case of gamers against Greg and Tom. He gives me a link on the thread on Board Game Geek, and then he says, this is the latest top 10 on the Dice Tower. Check out these guys' top 10, quote, disappointing games. Wow, they're really going out on a limb with these choices. I sure hope their review copy supplies don't dry up after this bomb was dropped. Yeah, we talked about this a little bit on one of my shows about how the games that they, Greg and them, disappointing games, they were really kind of unknown games and really weren't major issues. This is from Aaron in Australia. This is one of my favorites emails I got recently. Hey, Steve. But before the title on the email says, a big thank you to Tom. And it says, please keep reading. Hey, Steve, please don't let the subject put you off and keep reading. I would like to personally thank Tom Vassell and recommend him to be demoted to number 3 on your arch enemy list. I know you may ask why, but without Tom, I may never have found the revolution. It was about the time of episode 4 of the Ultimate Podcast when Tom first addressed the issues of the Ameritrash Revolution and goings-on of the Board Game Geek forums to which I was uninitiated. Following up on it, through nothing more than Tom's passing comment, I managed to find my way through to the Board Game Geek forum debates, then on to your wonderful podcast. Until that day, I was completely devoid of any awareness of my roots. But that first episode I listened to was a revelation. I was like a little lamb returning to the flock. I was an Ameritrash gamer and proud. Without Tom, I would have had no one to lead me your way. It was Tom himself who allowed me to see how dull and boring the delivery style of Tom truly was. That also allowed me to garner the true meaning of quality in a podcast. It was Tom's refusal to address the debate, and without him, I would never have gone looking. Surely, whether intentional or not, Tom leading at least one member of the flock back to the true podcast is deserving of him being placed behind Alan Moon on the archenemies list. This is not a petition to have him removed, but just a reflection that Tom's, quote, work has likely led more people to the Ameritrash Revolution than that of Alan's. Yours in mass dice rolling, Aaron. Great, great email, and I never looked at it that way, but that is a great point. Next email comes from Robert Martin after my show with Leo Zappa. And Robert says, today's episode was really good. Leo Zappa was a fantastic guest. Good show, man. He goes on to say, I particularly like the angle that he was a combat veteran, and that could add some real world analysis of how some of these games worked. That was pretty cool stuff. He was a very entertaining speaker, too. This show was a good balance of stick and solid content, fun stuff, Robert. Yeah, I agree with you, Robert. Leo was one of my favorite guests. If I had to pick a show that I liked recently, and it had to be that show, was because I guess because I like Memoir 44 so much, and we really talked about that. And yeah, I agree, it was a great show. And if you guys haven't caught that one, be sure to check that out. From Kyle again, he gives me a link to a podcast. I've never heard this podcast, onboardgames.net. He said there's a guy on the panel who reviews for Knucklebones magazines. He admits that Knucklebones has a policy that they will not print negative reviews. Needless to say, I'm not terribly interested in subscribing to Knucklebones. Kyle. Yeah, when I interviewed Ward Batty, he mentioned, we kind of touched on this. He said that Ward, you know, does freelance writing and reviews, and he says nobody will pay him to do a negative review. I consider these ADRs, ads disguised as reviews, is basically what they are. A lot of what you see on The Geek and and on Tom's podcast are not really reviews. They're ADRs. They're ads disguised as review. Because let's face it, Tom is compensated for his reviews. He's given free games. Maybe not cash, but it's the same thing. He's given something, and then he gives a good review. You almost never hear negative reviews from those guys. And we're going to touch on this later. Got into an extensive dialogue with Greg Schlosser by email on the fact that he didn't do negative reviews. He says he does, and you can be the you folks out there can be the judge on that. And when we talk about that later, and one more email I want to talk. Ward Batty sent me an email. He said he just got around listening to the podcast with his interview. He says, "Nice job, especially the theme song. It really made me laugh." Best, Ward. Yeah, I enjoyed talking to Ward. Ward was he's really out there doing it, you know, 30 game events a year, really bringing people in, you know, doesn't write a lot online. He's just actually doing the job out there, and we appreciate that. Ward, great talking to Ward. And that's just some of the emails I got for the show. I thought you might be interested in that. A lot of times you don't get a real objective sense of what people are thinking about the show, and I thought I wanted to read you some of those just so you could get that sense. So what else is going on in gaming right now? Of course, what is it? Hot off the press, the big news here. Mr. Skeletor banned. The bannings continue on Board Game Geek, and he was banned for 30 days for apparently posting an avatar they did not like, and I took one look at it, and you know, folks, I did not like it either. I can't believe Mr. Skeletor would do something like that. I was disgusted at that picture. Anybody knows when you're in that position, you don't raise your hands above your head. You at least grab her hair. Pull on her hair and do that. I mean, be a man. Women are from Venus, men are from Mars. I didn't know was all that hard. Everybody thinks you need a college degree, but loving comes easy, easy for me. All the men are jealous, all the women sigh. It doesn't take much for me to catch their eye. It's a natural gift that was given to me. Loving comes easy, easy for me. And nothing you learn in a book, you either got it or you don't. The ones that don't have it want it, and the ones that have it can't turn it on. Well, copy all my moves, you won't get it right. A suit that ain't yours is gonna fit too tight. Everybody thinks you need a college degree, but loving comes easy, easy for me. Yes, it does, and so does podcasting. Just listen to the smooth voice. All right, what else? What else? Let's talk about games a little bit. After all, that's why we're here, right? I like one of the comments by one of the guys that says, "Weeks does talk about games, but you have to wait for it." And I hope your wait is over. We're going to talk about games. While I was off, we played a lot of games over vacation. I want to talk about. It wasn't good. Got a lot of bad news to report on the gaming front of the ones I tried. Let's first talk about Vegas Showdown. I was looking forward to trying this, and this is anything but a showdown. The name of this game was obviously done by some marketing guy trying to sell as many copies as possible. You can't blame him for that, but it is nothing like, it is not a Vegas showdown. And I was talking to Ward Batty. Ward Batty, before we did his interview, went out to Las Vegas. He loves Las Vegas, as do I. I've been there many times. We both love playing craps. And this Vegas showdown game is not a showdown. The more proper name for this game should have been Casino Construction Kit, because that's what it is. And it's just about as boring. It falls into a category I label as a PDAG. What is a PDAG? P-D-A-G, a puzzle disguised as a game. And I said this about Pueblo in my review on Pueblo. If you want to look it up, it may still be there if it wasn't deleted on Board Game Geek. And one guy responded, Mr. Weeks, or whatever he said, it's not a puzzle unless it has a unique solution to it. And don't get all technical with me. When I say puzzle, I mean just a puzzle feel to it, not strictly a puzzle. Whether it is or not is not important. What is important is it does have that feel. And with Vegas Showdown, you're putting your different puzzle pieces or your showrooms on your little cheap paper mat. They did, all the others are okay, the other components, but you got these cheap paper mats, player mats, that they couldn't spring for cardboard on these things. And you're putting your rooms together and you're trying to maximize your floor space and optimize it to score. And you're trying to get these little diamond shapes to score. And another thing I don't like about this game, I was banker in this game, and it seems like I was busy all the time and couldn't concentrate on my game. If you're going to, let me give you a tip. If you're going to play Vegas Showdown, go ahead and hire a dealer from Las Vegas, because you're going to need one. Okay? Because you're busy all the time. It just felt like that. I was busy all the time. I did not like and do not recommend Vegas Showdown for you. I'm sorry to say, even though it is an Avalon Hill game company, I like Avalon Hill Hasbro, I should say, but it's just not, it didn't make it for me. Vegas Showdown, not recommended. Moving on, this was a game, Fire and Axe, I was really looking forward to. Read the rules on the plane going over on my vacation. Was really excited to try it. It looked beautiful. Beautiful game. Really an upgrade from Viking Fury, which was on a tea towel. But I got to tell you, I played the game, and it didn't make it. It didn't make it. Before we get to why it didn't make it, I want to tell you something about this game. I was reading the rule book, and in there, and I really hate this, these guys says, oh, by the way, Vikings never did wear horned helmets. Yeah, let me get the, I got the rule book right here. I don't want to misquote these scholars that wrote this rule book. It's under, on the last page, page 15 of the rule book. It's a glossary and preconceived notions. And it's the very first item in red there. Horned helmets. Vikings never wore horned helmets, period. That's what they said. Vikings never wore horned helmets, period. However, certain tribes of Gauls, such as Carnutes, if I'm saying that right, did. Now, I just didn't buy this because, you know, I really hate these people that try to redo history. So I did a little research on this, and when my source here is on the internet, the Straight Dope is the site, and they address this. Did Vikings really wear horns on their helmets is the question. And it comes from Thad in San Antonio asked that question, and their staff replies. It says, no self-respecting Viking warrior ever wore a horned helmet in battle. They weren't that dumb. As anyone who has ever done any slaughtering can tell you, horns provide nothing more than a good handhold to steady your work while slitting someone's throat. Now, I know what you're thinking. They're agreeing with the guy that wrote the rule book. But let me continue on down here. However, popular belief to the contrary isn't entirely baseless. Historical and archaeological evidence indicates that priests among the Norse and early Germanic peoples did wear headgear with horns in religious ceremonies. So saying that Vikings never did wear helmets with horns is false. Obviously the priests did. And it's not too far of a stretch to say that you saw a Viking with a horned helmet, at least in a ceremony. So I know what you're thinking. Why am I bringing all this up? It's because, true, Vikings didn't wear helmets with horns in battle, and this game, there's no battle in it, so they may as well have been wearing horns with helmets. This game, Fire and Axe, was a big disappointment. Big, big disappointment, because we played it, and as it went on and on, it was just more of a accounting exercise, all right? You're just trading a bunch of stuff. You know, Vikings may not have worn helmets with horns, but they didn't wear suits with ties either, and that's what this felt like, or walking around with trade agreements. There is some battle, and they have raiding of cities, but it felt more like going into a ceramics shop, picking up a little city figurine and you know, paying the price for that. It didn't feel like any battle. And in fact, the people I played it with, they said, you know what this game needs is more boat-to-boat combat, more battle. And I've heard this, and I'm sure you guys have seen this too in comments on Fire and Axe, that there's not much, or Viking Fury as well, there was not much fury in it, and it's what really needed, and it was a big disappointment on that front. So unfortunate, beautiful game, beautiful, beautiful game. But and if you, this is one of those games too, if you read the rule book and man, and you reviewed it on that, you would give it a high review. But no, yeah, just can't recommend it. It's just rather dry and not much fun at all. In fact, when I played it, one of the guys was looking at his watch, you know, and that's not a good sign. He wasn't that drawn into the game. So I can't recommend Fire and Axe for you. And the biggest bomb of all over my this next game was so looking forward to this game, Space Dealer. Because I think, man, what a unique game. You got these egg timers and everybody's playing at once. What a turkey this game is. What a bomb. I give it to the designers. You designers, you did your job. You came up with a unique game. But how this game, where the game really failed and where it should have been stopped in production is at the playtesting stage. And the guys that playtested this game, you need to be given your pink slips, all right? Because obviously, they must have known the designers. I don't know what it was, but it in the playtesting stage, you should have realized the limited playability. And what this game falls into the perfect example of what I call the GBGs. GBGs. GBGs standing for gimmick before game. The designers came up with a gimmick, packaged it, put it in a box, and shoved it out in the market before it was really playtested. There was no game there. They didn't really. And so now I'm really upset at this, because this is where I differ from guys like Tom. Tom gets these games free and is not as harsh on these games. I laid out a lot of money, 50 or more bucks for this game. And so I want my money back. And I'm stuck with a bunch of egg timers that, you know, all I can do now, I have no desire to play the game. I just want to, all I can do is make a bunch of poached eggs now. So, you know, it's, and this is a real thing. When you lay out hard-earned money for a game, and you have every right to tell what you really think about it. And that's where this show, my show, differs from a lot of the other shows that are really commercial enterprises. We're untouchable here. We really are, and we don't accept anything. We just give you our opinion. And when I say my opinion, it's not necessarily mine personally. All right, I'm giving you a compilation of the whole experience in my monologue here of what the comments were along with mine, and giving you the general idea of what the play experience was like. And this was a miserable play experience. In fact, one of the guys that played it says, I hope you didn't spend too much money on this game. And I say, yes, I did. and I agree with you, it was not worth it. I noticed on some of the sites this game was on sale, and you can see why. I mean, and I don't really fault the designers. Like I said, the designers came up with something unique, and it's not entirely their fault. They're working to come out with something different. I applaud that, but the playtesters really let us down here. In the playtesting stage, you should have realized that, like I said, it was not much of a game. And so, not recommended, Space Dealer. One I did play that I do recommend, getting away from some of the negativity here, Formula Day Mini. I'm a big fan of Formula Day. Great game, and I never played the Mini. In my head, I tried to go in with an open mind, but in my head, man, this is going to be bad because, you know, I like the regular Formula Day. It's trying to abbreviate it. It's trying to make it, you know, even more Euro. But I had a good time with the game, and so did everybody that played it. I was really amazed in Formula Day Mini that you get 20 life chips instead of your normal pad like you have in keeping track of the brakes and stuff on regular Formula Day. You just get 20 life chips that come into play. And the balance there of those chips was really worked out well. 20 on these smaller tracks really works well, and you're getting down to the last ones, and you actually see in our games, we saw where they have a rule, the turbo boost rule, which if you fall short of hitting the corner, you can pay 3 of your life chips to boost one more and get in that corner, so you don't have to downshift and pay any more chips. But it's amazing how that was all worked out, and it's really a lot of fun. That was enjoyed. Good game there. I'll be honest with you, some of the old standards that were played and still enjoyed is Schottentotten. Great game there, even though it is a Reiner game. I hate to admit it, but it was a great game. And Corsari, the pirate game, got a lot of play, and it was a great game as well. So that gives you a sense of some of my gaming over the holiday while I was off and my takes on what I played. We're going to talk to who we're talking to here. We're talking to Glenn Drover now of Eagle Games, or formerly of Eagle Games. Now, I don't usually talk to game designers on this show, but I wanted to talk to Glenn for several reasons. The first reason, of course, being that I'm a huge fan of all the Eagle games that they've come out with, including Age of Mythology, which I really think gets a bad rap on the geek. And it was mainly due to the timing on the thing, because it came out when the Euros were on top of the world. And it's really not as bad a game as you would think. It's really innovative. And we talked with Glenn about this, about how he combined, one of the first to combine Euro mechanics with American mechanics in Age of Mythology. I'm a big fan of all the Eagle games, like I said. And we talked to Glenn. The other reason I want to talk to him is because he took such a beating on the Board Game Geek. And we talk about a little bit about game critics and what he thinks about those, and if they're useful, and negative reviews, and his take on those is interesting. I think you'll find that interesting. Glenn works for PopCap Games now. I don't know if you are familiar with those. If you're familiar with the game Zuma and some Bejeweled, or just a couple of the great games that they come out with, nice, easy, great computer games that are... I love myself and have quite a few on my computer. So let's talk to Glenn right now. Well, let's talk about board gaming. Do you have a new company in board gaming? What's going on with that?
Yeah, Tropical is basically just me. It's a design company that I started to just act as the corporate entity. But it's basically just me designing games, and obviously now that I have a full-time job, doing it in my spare time. So, not an aggressive release schedule planned, maybe one game a year, but, focusing on quality and publishing the games that I've been working on for a while. So, Age of Empires just hit the market, and the next game that I'm working on is a game called History, which is a civilization-building game, and it uses some of the same game mechanics that Age of Empires 3 has.
Right. So
basically taking the, you know, what's successful about Age of Empires, and I guess you could call it an extension of the same kind of gameplay, but putting it into kind of that civ building milieu. So.
Right. Tell me about your game design philosophy. Where do you fall? What is a fun factor more important than mathematical perfection, or how do you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's really theme first. So I'm a historian. That's my training and kind of my field of interest. So I go and find a theme that I'm really into. And kind of with this project, Bruce Shelley had told me a few years ago that, you know, the next game from Ensemble was going to be an Age of Discovery era game, and I got real interested. And so what I'll do is I'll research, you know, the period and get lots of inspiration. And then I'll go and start, you know, seeing how the gameplay might lay out. And that's kind of the second step in saying, okay, what's interesting and fun about this topic and how might it, you know, be made into a game. And so I'll create kind of a prototype, you know, of a game and see how that plays. And usually the first prototype is terrible, but there's some nuggets of value there. And then we'll go and make a second iteration. And
right.
Go that way. So it's really theme first and game mechanics second, but you know the game mechanics are key. It's what's fun. How do you create a situation where there's lots of interesting decisions?
Right.
I think that's something that Sid Meier said that really resonated with me years ago. Is, you know, the player should be able to make lots of interesting decisions. I think
right.
That's really, you know, a key element in great game design.
You were really one of the first designers. Going back a few years ago to kind of fuse together the Euro mechanics with the American style games with, I guess, Age of Mythology. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we did Civilization before that, and that had a couple of Euro mechanics. I mean, it drew some inspiration from Settlers and other things, but it was really more of an Ameritrash game.
Right.
You know, given that it was like 8 hours long. And you know, I actually created a more Euro, simpler version of the game, but no one seemed to want to play it. You know, it was the standard version. We had the simple, the basic, the standard, and the advanced. And the hardcore gamers just jumped right into the advanced and skipped over the standard. So there was more of a 3-hour, 4-hour version of the game that was more Euro mechanic. But people kind of ignored it to play.
People, was that the play testers? Or?
No, the people who bought the game, they kind of ignored the standard version, thinking that it was just, you know, a hobbled version of full game. And but really, it was a game that was meant to stand alone for people who liked that type of a thing, where they didn't want to sit there all day and play, and they wanted to finish the game in 3 hours. And it was actually not a bad game. It probably could have used 4 to 6 more months of playtest, but probably should have published that and left the full, you know, expansion, you know, out of it, not done the tweaked up, you know, monster version of the game.
That's interesting.
Would have been better. But Age of Mythology was probably the first, you know, more Euro and focused, you know, with a single design instead of trying to offer 3 games in a box, had a lot of Euro mechanics inspired by several games, including Puerto Rico and, you know, some Settlers and some other games. But, it was a fusion of Euro games and a PC license.
Yeah, we were talking about designers. There was a great article I read on the internet a while back about someone posed the question, does a game designer really need to be a player, a game player? What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think all players are game designers to an extent. It's just a question of how far you're willing to go.
Right.
You know, everyone's got their pet game design, but oftentimes people stop working on it before it really gets to the point where it's truly a finished game, and so it's kind of this work in progress forever. But yeah, I think you have to be a player.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
Understand what's fun about games. How can you do something and design something that you don't utilize and enjoy?
Well, talk about a player. What games are you playing right now? What would we find on your table?
Board games or computer games?
Board games.
Board games, played recently. I finally got around to playing Kalis a couple of months ago.
What's your thoughts on that?
Which, yeah, I really enjoyed, but it's funny because people compare some of the elements of Age of Empires to Kalis, and the ironic thing is I never played that game before.
Ah, okay.
I only played it 2 months ago for the first time. I think an Italian gentleman was in a game store on a game night, and I was there with a friend, and he was patient enough to explain and play the game with us, and really enjoyed it. But yeah, it's got some similarities, but really different from Age of Empires.
Right. What's your take on the state of Euro games right now? Do you think they're losing favor or gaining favor or what?
I think over the last year I've kind of lost touch with the market a little bit since Eagle shut down, but I'm more in touch with kind of the people on the Board Game Geek and on the internet. I guess from a business point of view, it may have lost some steam because a couple of years ago there were a lot of companies
right
developing and publishing games, and I think the market is a smaller market, and there's probably not room for more than a dozen or two new games a year. And if you come out with 100 games, the market can't absorb all those.
I got to tell you, this is everybody I've talked to absolutely loves your game Attack with the expansion, and it seemed to get a bad rap, but I mean everybody I talked to loves it, including myself. Can you tell us about how that game came about?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a particular story. I was on a flight to Toy Fair in New York a few years ago, and I was kind of, we had published a lot of big box, very expensive games, and I was trying to find a way that we could appeal to, very casual gamers in America, as well as the hardcore. And I said, okay, Risk is the most well-known and simple to get into, strategy game that most American men have played at some point in their lives.
Right.
And I thought, okay, it's a decent game, but there's too much luck. It's too repetitive. How do I do something that looks and feels like that, but is just a cleaner design and has more, strategy to it rather than luck? And so I came up with the idea of, let's theme it World War II, because that's very appealing to an American audience. And
right.
Came up with the game mechanics pretty quickly. And then I said, okay, now I need to make an expansion pack for this that will combine to make a bigger game that has more depth for the hardcore strategy guys. And so it was really trying to do two things in one. I had tried to do that with my early games, offering three different levels of, play in one box, and that didn't seem to work, because if you're going to spend $50, $60 on the game, you're going to play, the full version of it. You're probably not a casual gamer.
Right. Uh-huh.
So the Attack thing was a way to go to market with a very simple game for $20 at retail, and then you could layer onto it if you were a hardcore gamer. So it was a way to cover both markets and hopefully bring some new people into the hobby.
I picked up my copy of Attack in Toys R Us, and is that a real challenge to get like some of your games like Bootleggers and others from the Eagle line into Toys R Us?
Yeah, actually, Attack was the only one we ever did get into toys. We tried to continue to diversify the offering to appeal to more mainstream retailers like Target and Walmart and Toys, but it never really clicked. I mean, we picked up the Lord of the Rings kids game and got some traction in some of the bookstores, but really the Toys R Us buyer just had too many Lord of the Rings products that year.
Right.
And we did some party games that I thought were quite good, including the Wits and Wagers product, which I think is a phenomenal game.
Right. That gets a lot of praise as well. I have not played it, but it really gets a lot of praise. You designed that game?
I did not. That was an acquisition.
Okay.
For us, we did kind of a publishing deal with some really good designers that are Euro game designers as well. They've got some really clever Euro designs, kind of similar to what we did with Bootleggers. Was designed by a real clever group of U.S. Euro game designers, and it just had a little bit of input on polishing up some of the design. But we looked for ways to augment my design so we could diversify the company's offering.
Right. Now, going back to Age of Mythology, a lot of criticism on that game goes to the attack system. How do you respond to that criticism? If you had to do it over, would you change that attack system in Age of Mythology?
You know, it was strange. I was asked by the guys at Ensemble to do kind of two different things, and I probably should have said they weren't possible in the same product. One was to create kind of a Euro game, because they were big fans there of Euro gaming. But I was also asked to make a game that had lots of, you know, kind of dice rolling, Titan-esque, you know, combat.
Right.
That took advantage of all the different types of units. And probably, yeah, if I knew what I know now, then I would say, you know, that can't be done in the same product. It takes you out of the kind of the Euro game mechanic too much, and would have made a more streamlined, elegant combat system for that game.
Right. You mentioned Age of Empires. Tell me about that. That is out now, right?
Yeah, we shipped it about 2 weeks ago almost, and it's now reaching stores, and actually some of the online guys, especially the gentleman who bought out EagleGames.net, they shipped out a bunch direct to consumers, and so we're actually, I think there's about 37 people have rated the game now.
Yeah, one of the really neat ideas I thought your company had was that you were taking computer games and putting them into the board game format. Was that your idea, or how did that come about?
Actually, I had the opposite idea when I founded Eagles. Coming from the video game and computer game industry, I thought it would be kind of neat to design some original games and then license them for PC development later.
Oh, okay.
And the idea to do the other thing came to me when a friend of mine, who was at that time licensing director or VP at Atari, he owned the Civilization rights, and he came to me and said, "Hey, you know, I understand you're doing these really high quality board games, and we're really interested in having a PC or a board game version of Civilization. Do you think you could do that?" And I almost fell out of my chair. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm a huge Civilization fan, and having worked at MicroProse when we launched that game." Just absolutely fell in love with it. So I jumped at the opportunity, and so it kind of landed in my lap, and you know, I instantly,
okay.
You know, my brain was there already, and I thought, well, gosh, this could really work.
What happened to the Pirates game? Are we going to see that?
Good question. Yeah, I've got, finally, after like four iterations, I have a design that I really like I've been fiddling with.
What's been the problem on that? You're not satisfied with it, or?
Yeah, I mean, for me anymore, now that I don't have to, you know, churn out products to feed the monster of overhead,
right,
I want
right.
to make sure that they're, you know, fully tested and the best design possible. And the first, you know, two or three designs I put on the table just were not good. You know, they had lots of piratey goodness, but they just didn't work as games. And so I rejected them, threw them in the garbage, and started over. And I know, you know, people have been waiting a long time for the pirate product.
Right, right.
And but when, you know, if and when I publish one, it's going to be a great game. You know, it's going to be something that, you know, you're going to just absolutely, it'll be the best pirate game ever done. And very playable, because, I mean, the challenge in a pirate game is it's really an adventure game. And to tell the story of, you know, that adventure while you're able, you know, while you're playing a strategy type product is
right.
challenging. And I think a lot of pirate products that I've seen and people presented to me actually are either too dry and don't have the pirate feel, or they're too much about, you know, the adventure, and they just drag on, and it's a pirate experience, and it's not a tight, you know, fun competitive game.
Right. Have you played Pirate's Cove? Did you think that was too dry as well?
I've played it. It's actually, you know, probably the best kind of pirate themed game. But it's just not all the way satisfying.
Doesn't have an edge, or
yeah, it's just, you know, you're kind of, you know, upgrading your stuff and going along, and it's kind of piratey, but it doesn't feel authentic enough, you know.
Right. Looks like one of. It looks like the universal opinion is of your biggest hit was Railroad Tycoon. Is that right?
Yeah, so far I think, but I think Age of Empires 3 should rival it. I think it's
really okay. It's, good
for me. It's I love both games, but I think Age is actually slightly better and will appeal to Euro gamers a little bit more.
Are we going to see Railroad Tycoon 2? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't. The thing is, I don't have the license anymore.
Okay.
Deal went down. The relationship with Take-Two ended, and they are looking elsewhere for a vehicle to deliver their licenses. So you will see a pirate product from me that will not be Sid Meier's Pirates, and you will see a railroad, you know, the next iteration of that game design without the Railroad Tycoon license.
Right. Let me ask you a question on these different board game websites. You know, we have the prolific reviewers on there. In your opinion, how much does their reviews, good or bad, affect the sales of one of your products?
Well, I think in the very well informed Eurogame fan audience, it probably does affect that significantly. If we were talking about the general audience, probably not at all. You know, so it really depends on which audience you're aiming at.
Right.
So I would say, you know, they're hopefully very helpful if they give you a positive review, because you can kind of rise above, you know, the rest of the crowd of games that come out every year.
Do you read those reviews on your products?
Sure do. Absolutely. For good or ill. I mean, when you know, that's, I think, a big part of why I've gotten better as a designer is listening to real criticism. I mean, there are people that just don't like your game because it's not their taste. But when people, you know, give you really good in-depth feedback, you really need to listen to that, and it can be a great learning experience. And
so do you get more out of a negative review or a positive review?
Well, my I guess, you know, you like to hear the positive.
Right.
You don't learn anything, right?
So, right, exactly.
You know, and over the last 7 years, you know, I think I've learned, you know, a fair amount from hearing the things that people didn't like or wish were different. So it's a good thing.
Right. That's kind of where I was going with, because there's a lot of reviewers that tend not want to do, they don't want to do these negative reviews, you know, they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I mean, from a designer's viewpoint, do you see it that way? Or I mean,
yeah, the only thing that I prefer is that they that they're fair. You know, I mean, there were a couple of reviews, and probably not by the official reviewers, more the kind of the consumers. You know, they'll make statements that you're just like, well, that's just maybe not valid, or you maybe didn't play the game more than once. But as long as they're fair, and I think that you know, they're relatively accurate, I think it's fine. They should be able to say whatever is the truth.
Right. Where do you see the future of board gaming going? I mean, as far as your thoughts on that?
I think it's a good question. I think, you know, there was this big boom of people that discovered these Euro-type games, and then it's kind of settled down, and it's kind of getting more established, you know, to the size that it should be. But I think there's still an opportunity to bring these types of games to a mass audience, and games like Ticket to Ride and Carcassonne are great gateway games and have that potential to continue to get people involved in board gaming who otherwise wouldn't.
Right, exactly.
Because you know, American consumers especially, you know, they don't, most of them don't know what a good game is. They play, you know, absolute direct like Monopoly and
right.
games that are luck-based and just an activity really more than a
right.
real interesting game. And, you know, I think when they discover these games, especially the ones that are a little lighter and easier to get into, their eyes open and they go, wow, that was, you know, totally different than anything I've played before.
Yeah, I think I was looking at Christmas. I go into Toys R Us and you see all the kids finally latching on to HeroScape. You know, they're seeing, I think if you can get the product in the stores and give, you know, a good product and let the people get an opportunity to try it, I think they're going to like it. But the problem is I go into Target and I see the same thing, you know, Monopoly, sorry, Risk, you know, and only recently, you know, a HeroScape and of course the party games, and that's it.
Right.
I want to go in there and see, I want to see all Fantasy Flight. I want to see all of your line lined up in there. just for convenience, you're going to get more players. And it's, you know, if I can't sleep at night, I want to go down to 24-hour Walmart and look over your what you got out, you know. But it's
I think part of it's price and part of it's licensing.
A lot
of those stores are really driven by big licenses and being able to sell a game for, you know, $12, and it's a challenge because, you know, a quality product is going to cost more. I mean, for example, our games, we're now making everything in the U.S. except the plastic, and it's more expensive to do that. You know, we're not, you know, making this stuff really cheaply over in China. and you know, making it for $5.
Exactly.
So that's the challenge. I mean, price point is king in the mass retail.
Right. So you always see, you think board gaming is always going to be a niche hobby, or is it really going to take off again? What do you think?
Well, it could be either, really. I mean, it could take off. The challenge is that most Americans get their entertainment electronically.
Yeah.
And that's become, you know, more and more reinforced.
But, you know, if you remember back, right, if you remember back to the early 80s, video games were still king. And, you know, the arcades, and you had the Atari and so forth. But then these guys come out with Trivial Pursuit, and I was on college campus. It went crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody had. I mean, where I worked, they were reading the cards. It was just an explosion. And it was a real interesting story to read about those guys. They went to that toy fair. You talked about going to a toy fair. Those guys go to one. It was rejected. They sold a few copies, but they kept at it. And, it, you know, it became a national phenomenon. I think some of these games could do the same thing if we could just get them out there.
Yeah, I think it is possible, especially if, you know, if a designer can make a game that can appeal to everyone.
Right.
And that's actually what's really interesting about PopCap is they're making games that are really aimed at everyone, and they have a large female audience. They're really easy to get into, but deep and layered. I think the guys here are really doing some amazing things.
Do they make are they the ones that they made Zuma, right?
They do, yeah.
I love that game. Fantastic.
Yeah, they're really, you know, trying to make games for a wide audience, and I think that's the key. If you want to have that kind of explosion and this mass kind of realization of the fun of gaming, that's really a thing you need to do, is make the game easy to get into, but really rewarding.
Right, easy, but not so easy that you're just, you know, moving men around on a board, but, you know,
yeah, right.
The experience, right?
Layering is the key, is you at least what, you know, with casual gaming on the PC, it's you start off real simple, and the next level something is added, and then so on and so forth through, so in the first 20, 30 minutes, you learn to play the game, but you're having fun while you're doing it.
Right. Well, Glenn, I know you're busy, and I don't want to take your whole night. I just want to thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Uh-huh. And good luck with your and we're looking forward to that pirate game coming out, especially.
Yeah, it's when it comes out, you know, it'll be you know, a good one.
Do we have a date on that?
Absolutely not. I'm
all right.
Guessing it'll be next year.
Next year.
You know, maybe fall of 08.
Fall of 08. Great. All right. Thanks again, Glenn.
Take care. Thank you.
All right, same to you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot to Glenn Drover for stopping by. Interesting stuff in the interview, especially about the negative reviews and so forth. His opinion on those is great to talking with Glenn. That's all we got this time. Be sure to tune in next week when we talk to Dirk Solko of Board Game Geek. See you later. Thanks a lot.